No, that's completely fine. Like I said, it's not my first time around technological difficulties.
Well, we have it all sorted out this morning, so it should work fine. And I'm just going to run through the questions roughly of what I sent. I guess it was a week back or so, but I hope it's interactive if you have any other, you know, take the conversation however you want to take it. So are we all ready, my lord? Great. Fantastic. All right. Well, we'll get going. I'm Melanie Towns with the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Today we have us Mo Khan from South Asian Americans Leading Together, or SALT. Next week, Mo, the nation will observe the 10th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on 9/11. SALT has been actively working with not only South Asian community, but also Muslim and interfaith communities to help frame and enhance the dialogue around the anniversary. Can you tell us a little bit more about that campaign? How does it engage the public? What messages do you hope it will share?
Great. SALT launched our campaign to mark the 10 years since September 11th earlier this year, and it's called An America for All of Us. The campaign aims to document and elevate the voices and experiences of South Asians and other communities in the dialogue around 9/11. The campaign also works to hold policymakers accountable, to stand up against xenophobic language, and pursue policies that fight discrimination and profiling. Throughout the campaign, we've mobilized community members in a few ways. First and foremost, we've worked with groups around the country to organize events at the local level, where community members can learn more about post-9/11 backlash and how it has impacted their region and our country. You can find a map of events around the country on our you can find a map of events around the country on our website, www.salt.org. We also have some e-advocacy tools that people around the country can use to get engaged, including sending the campaign Pledge for Policymakers to their member of Congress and senators. The message our campaign really wants to share is that at its core, September 11th was a tragedy, resulting in a startling loss of life and a traumatic attack on our country. However, in the aftermath of the day, certain communities that had observed and mourned the tragedy became targets for harassment, hate crimes, and heightened unwarranted scrutiny.
That's great. And so you mentioned that you're speaking with different communities around. In what ways are they commemorating? Are there vivid or moving observances that you can share with us?
Absolutely. Different organizations around the country are commemorating the 10 years since in a variety of ways, and I think they're really reading their own communities and their regions to figure out what works best. So I think there's all kinds of events, including vigils, there are memorial walks, there are events to raise money for charities, blood drives. There are other events also that get into some content areas that actually talk about what's happened, offer people the opportunity to share their own remembrances, or to talk about how their region or how their locality has changed since 9/11, what the post-9/11 world looks like for them, you know, whether they're in New York or D.C. or in Oklahoma or Nebraska or, Kansas City, things like that. So I think all around the country, organizations are really trying to look to what we need to do to really take account of the loss and the remembrance of that, and also what other things do our communities want to hear about related to our post-9/11 world.
And immediately following 9/11, I know faith groups played a prominent role in helping the country. And in our 10th anniversary, how do you see faith groups playing a role again? In what ways are they stepping up to commemorate the anniversary and speak to that unity within the country?
Absolutely. Well, I think faith groups, first and foremost, I think they bring a really strong lens around the concept of free exercise of faith and the concept that we were all really impacted in so many ways by the events of 9/11, regardless of our background, and that almost all faith backgrounds call upon us to look upon this time as a moment for us to come together, to bring unity, to remember the unity that prevailed after 9/11, and to remind ourselves that all of our faith backgrounds, call upon us to look to our neighbors, to share these experiences, and to really work together towards the solutions that we want to see implemented. So I think there's been all kinds of work done, with interfaith groups who have come together to not just commemorate the event, but also, in the years since, as certain faith groups have become, I think, a little bit more controversial, or their right to freely express their religion become a little bit more of a visible struggle. I think a lot of interfaith work has been done by other other faith groups to kind of stand up for that right, stand up for the right to have mosques in your locality, to be allowed to wear hijabs, to be allowed to wear your turban. And so we've really seen a lot of amazing work done by our allies in other faith communities who have stood up and said, you know, Muslims have a right to do this. Sikhs have a right to do this. It's, you know, you're saying something just as bad as, you know, Jews are not allowed to build synagogues. Christians aren't allowed to build churches. You're doing that by attacking the rights of Muslims, of Sikhs, of Arab Americans, of South Asians. So I think that there's been so much work done in the interfaith space that we've established a really strong set of principles around, equality of all religions, in this country and, you know, really fighting back against the forces that sometimes, you know, try to make, the exercise of certain religions a little, you know, more controversial than others.
Right, right. I know everyone has a story to tell around 9/11. For our generation, it's been the Kennedy moment, where they were when they heard of the attacks. And a big part of your campaign is storytelling. Can you share some of those stories with us that you've come across during your work? And what are, especially, what are the unique experiences of the South Asian community and their stories in this post-9/11 America?
Absolutely. You know, as I kind of said before, South Asians, like all Americans, experienced September 11th primarily as this violent, tragic attack that it was. And so I think at its core level, that is part of our essential 9/11 story. It is also that in the aftermath that we began to see the distinct and different ways that our community, along with other communities like Muslim, Sikh, and Arab Americans, would be targeted by post-9/11 backlash. In the week immediately following September 11, 2001, our organization, as part of a report, found that 645 reported incidents targeting South Asians and Middle Easterners occurred. There were also large-scale roundups of Muslim communities. In 2002, we saw the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, which began the mandatory registration and questioning of certain male nationals from a number of Muslim-majority countries, including Bangladesh and Pakistan. While no national security threats were identified, more than 13,000 of the 84,000 men who registered were placed in deportation proceedings for minor immigration violations. I think another hallmark of the post-9/11 South Asian story has been school bullying and profiling at airports. Gurwinder Singh, who actually spoke at a briefing that SALT organized during our National South Asian Summit in April, related his experiences of bullying at the hands of his classmates, which ran the gamut from verbal taunts to serious violent attacks on his person. Many Sikh and Muslim travelers report disproportionate secondary screenings when they're traveling. One particularly moving story, I think, is that of Talat Hamdani, who also spoke at the briefing in April. Talat's story is really closely tied to the events of September 11th. Her son, Salman, was an EMT in training who, like so many courageous first responders, went to downtown Manhattan to help. And as the dust was settling from the attacks and the building collapses, questions began being raised about whether, you know, Salman was actually involved in the attack. And Thalit's powerful words described how these personal attacks on her son's character hurt the family, you know, beyond measure, and led her to become a vocal advocate for not just honoring the memory of her son and the other victims of the attack, but to defend the core American values that stand against smearing someone based on their religion and ethnicity, let alone somebody who had, you know, so courageously gone to help in that situation. So I think those are some of the hallmarks of, I think, the South Asian post-9/11 experience, the stories that we hear. There's a level of just incredible mourning and loss at the events itself, but then it was followed by this unexpected, I think, backlash that really targeted our community, that made us a visible, a group that suddenly became scrutinized, that became somebody that should be pulled aside for questioning, should be pulled aside for screening, should be pulled aside for interrogation. And I think that is one of the hallmarks of our post-9/11 experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a powerful story of Talib's family. How are we working to get those stories out into the public and relatable to, as we think about the 9/11 anniversary and get these stories to those who might not know about that backlash or who might see statistics of attacks or profiling or bullying, but maybe need to humanize the stories more and connect with the South Asian community on these issues?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, we're hoping to capture and document these as part of our campaign. And I think a really big part of that is also to hear from the community and from different community members. We're not just talking South Asians here or other affected communities, say like Muslim, Sikh, or Arab Americans. I think we are all a part of this post 9/11 world. And what we want to do as part of an America for all of us is to create a platform that allows people to really engage with it, to document their own stories, to bring in their own remembrance of the day, to talk about how they feel their community has shifted or changed since in the 10 years since. And so as part of the campaign, we want to hear from community members around the country, and we have, about their experiences, about their remembrances, etc. And we want to continue doing that, and you can always send your information if you have a story that you'd like to tell, if you have a question that you'd like answered. We have an email address that you can use for the campaign, which is America, AMERICA, 4, the number 4, at salt.org. And it's a way for us to really hear from different people. And it's been a really great way to engage with people all around the country, not just in the places where we think of this stuff, like, in the East Coast and things like that, but people all around the country, throughout the Midwest, in the South, the West Coast, etc. So I think we're just starting to get a sense of all these different stories and how important it is for us to document and disseminate it. And so in terms of the dissemination, we are really trying to profile that as part of the work that we're doing, not just in terms of updating our membership about this campaign, but we also, as part of the campaign, have been convening something called, we've been calling the Allies Call, which is just giving an opportunity for many of our partner organizations in the faith community, other civil rights organizations, organizations that work within some of the communities that are considered post 9/11 backlash communities. It's that we kind of convene a regular opportunity for us to all talk about the work that we're doing and really share some of the strategies that are working and these stories that are really important and that are specific to our communities, but also speak to broader experiences and realities in the post 9/11 world and how we can work together to make sure that these stories are going out and people are able to actually hear them and interact with them and get a better sense of what these last 10 years have been like for members of these communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talked about those broader experiences. Are there, as you document these stories, are there things that keep on coming up that are surprising to you, commonalities that you wouldn't expect the American public to speak about?
Well, I think that there are, first and foremost, I just think that there is many different elements of post 9/11 backlash. And I think, that's terminology that we use at our organizations because we've been really deeply steeped in this work for a long time. Mm-hmm. I think what part of the challenge is to explain what we mean by that term to people who are not as familiar with it. So I think that that's one big thing, to really draw together so many of the different phenomena that we're describing, which is, the school bullying, harassment in the workplace, hate crimes, government policies, etc., bringing together all of these disparate elements of what we actually see as part of this whole kind of concept of post 9/11 backlash, and I think making a case for it. And I think that, in different ways, people around the country may interact with different aspects of this. They may notice this happening, when they're out in the public sphere. They may hear somebody making comments towards a Muslim woman or a Sikh man or something like that, when they're at the grocery store, or maybe they notice that happening in their workplace, or maybe they hear about it from their child at school. So they may have like kind of different experiences or entry points into the concept that this might exist. And I think part of what we need to do is really to tie those together and show how they work together in a concerted way to change how certain communities are able to live and work and be, people of this country freely. And to really try to tie that together to show what an effect all of these things coming together can be for a person, a South Asian person, a Muslim person, a Sikh person, an Arab American person in this country. And I think that might be one of the more unique elements, because I think people experience it and they see it in different ways, but where is the lens to tie all of these elements together to show that there is something happening and it's concerted and there are different bodies at work who, can either perpetuate these stereotypes or perpetuate this kind of negative viewpoint around these communities. And then there are people who are kind of doing the opposite, and how can we tie that together and show what's really going on? And I think also considering that in a lot of ways, post 9/11 backlash, what it actually looks like on the ground has really shifted in a lot of ways. Like, we're seeing so much in terms of the rise of Islamophobia. I know that CAP put out an amazing report that really talked about, you know, what the roots of some of that political Islamophobia comes from. And I think that it's really incumbent upon us to relate that back to some of the narratives that emerged after 9/11, because it's a big part of post 9/11 backlash work, but it's shifting. It's becoming about different things. It's becoming about building mosques. It's becoming about anti-Sharia laws, etc. And so I think it's really incumbent upon us to be able to present a thoughtful and realistic lens as to how these are related, because it's going to continue to change. Backlash isn't going to look the same all the time. You know, in a lot of ways, I think bullying is one of those really interesting parts of it, because we're seeing younger and younger people perpetrating and being the victims of bullying, who are further and further away from the 9/11 moment. And so it's obviously metastasizing and changing in different directions. And so, you know, it's incumbent upon us to build a lens and a worldview that makes sense of all of this, that can show how these changes are still part of the same kind of essential backlash, and how, you know, we need to understand these new developments and also develop new tools to combat it, and new partnerships and new forms of solidarity and relationships to build a real movement against this sort of backlash.
Yeah, absolutely. And along those lines, part of the campaign is to engage community and advocacy with policymakers. So whether that is Islamophobia concerns, or any sort of political rhetoric, or issues of bullying or hate crimes, what are the ways in which you are encouraging community members to engage? What are those policy priorities?
Well, first and foremost, we encourage our community members to stay engaged with their policymakers at every level, at the local, state, and federal level. In general, it's your right, and it's almost in some ways your responsibility to let them know that they have constituents that care about these issues. They may not know if you don't tell them. They may not know really well how many Muslim Americans they have in their constituency, how many Sikh Americans, how many members of other communities that care about religious freedom, et cetera, and things like that. So I think that it's important for people to stay engaged with their policymakers in a general way, to let them know that you are their constituent, and you are like many of their constituents. You want them to take a stand against things that you find distasteful. You want them to stand up for values that you think are important, you know, like religious inclusion or equality in the eyes of the law, etc. In terms of the campaign on America for All of Us, one key aspect is something we call the Pledge for Policymakers, and I kind of alluded to it before. Mm-hmm. Community members around the country can send the pledge to their representatives to sign, and the pledge essentially commits the policymaker to three things. First is to support policies that strengthen anti-bias laws and eliminate profiling and discrimination. The second is to develop meaningful relationships with the South Asian and other communities, many of whom might be affected by post 9/11 backlash. And thirdly, to take a stand against xenophobic, Islamophobic, racist rhetoric in the public sphere. And you can send the pledge to your policymakers through our website, www.salt.org. And so you can use our e-advocacy tool to kind of automatically send it to your, you know, your member of Congress, your senators, and other federal representatives. And so, but you can also kind of print it out and take it to a meeting. Like I said, we really encourage you to stay engaged with your policymakers so they know what matters to you, so they know what their constituents care about and can act accordingly. So you can also kind of, as part of your legislative visits or anything like that, you can print it out and give it to them and say, you know, this matters to me. I think you should commit to these principles. They are, they really commit you at the very heart to essential American values: equality, justice, freedom, etc. So that's one way that people can really engage with policymakers as part of this campaign.
That's great. You spoke a little bit earlier about how young people had been impacted by 9/11 and along the issues of bullying. But as you compile all these stories and hear from communities around the country, do you feel like millennials have a unique experience to 9/11? And are they reporting different stories or understandings than the older generations?
I absolutely think that millennials have not only a unique experience of post 9/11 backlash, but I think also a really unique role to play in the movement building to combat it. And not just to combat, I think, post 9/11 backlash as an idea, but also this concept of, you know, really indoctrinating the targeting of certain minorities at any point. So I think that they really have a unique role to play in building a movement against something like this happening to any community, not just to post 9/11 backlash affected communities. I think, you know, I was 16 when 9/11 happened, 16 mm-hmm. or 17. I remember it so clearly. And, you know, and I might be a little bit unique. I might be on the kind of like the older end of the millennial generation in the sense that I remember what it was like to fly before 9/11. I remember mm-hmm. what it was like to not have to go through security screening. I remember waiting for, you know, my family members waiting at the gates to greet me. So,
right.
I would see them right when I got off the plane. You know, and so I remember that stuff. And it wasn't like these concepts didn't exist. It wasn't like the, you know, wearing a hijab or wearing a turban, you know, was not an issue at all before 9/11. You know, I think that there were different elements of backlash that came up after the 1993 bombings, etc. So it's not like everything was a perfect utopia before 9/11 and everything changed after it. But I do think that it was a different world. And I think that millennials bring a different experience. If you have no memory of flying before 9/11, this is the normal for you.
The
long security lines, being, you know, kind of subject to very intrusive pat downs or, you know, like naked body image scans, et cetera. Like that's kind of the normal. But I also think it gives you a certain, I think a different perspective. I think millennials are also growing up in a very multicultural world, and mm-hmm. the concept of diversity and multiculturalism are very deeply ingrained in their upbringings and in their worldview. I think we have a generation that looks critically upon things like racism or the concept of a post-racial world. I think they see realistically in their lives that they have a diverse group of friends or a diverse group of people with whom they go to school, and then they look out into the world and they see that the treatment that different people have, you know, out in the world, the way that they're treated by the government, the way that they're treated by other Americans as they're, you know, walking around, living their life, going to store, you know, going to the grocery, etc., is different. And I think in a lot of ways, from what I hear and what I feel being a millennial, is that essential break within how I see the world. I've grown up with people of many different races and religious backgrounds and national origins. And then I go out into the world and I see that people are not being treated in this like equal or egalitarian fashion. I think it presents a potential to really fight back against that in a new and innovative way. We have a generation of people who feel that multiculturalism deeply and who understand it as a core concept. And so I think that the role that they can play in creating and seeing innovative solutions that really come from their sense of their own community and their own generation, I think that that's really unparalleled. And the stories mm-hmm. that they're talking about, because they've grown up in the post 9/11 world, I think they can envision something really, really different. I think that they can envision a world where they bring a harmony to how they experience multiculturalism and diversity, and bring that to other places, to bring that to the public sphere, to show that this kind of behavior that, you know, that has kids being called terrorists or, you know, that has, you know, your mom, like my mother was once like, somebody just yelled Osama bin Laden at her in like a grocery parking lot. You know, I think that, you know, myself and other millennials, I know, like we see that, and we're scandalized by that to some extent, and we haven't become inured to it. Even though we've grown up in the post 9/11 world, I think we see that contradiction really strongly, and I think we have a lot of will to change it, to bring the world into harmony. If we grew up with people of all these different backgrounds and we've had such amazing relationships with them, I think we're committed to building a world where these relationships, this equality, is recognized in a uniform manner.
Right. Wow. And you spoke a little bit about your experience, but one final question is, can you tell us about your own story and how you got involved in this work at SALT?
Sure. I mean, like I said, I think I was like 16 or 17. It was my senior year of high school when 9/11 happened. And I think like so many people around the world, it was a formative event for me. My family had immigrated to the United States about 5 years before, and I was actually in no way prepared for how fundamentally it would shift my world. It would shift so much about my life, from how my classmates treated me to how I felt when I flew, you know, when I was flying, everything mm-hmm. changed. And I wasn't I wasn't prepared for that. I don't think I understood what was happening as it was going on. And I think that that sense of loss and sadness really motivated me to learn more about what was really happening, what was contributing to the sense of this place that I had moved to that I loved so deeply, you know, a school that I enjoyed going to, how all of those things could change so quickly. I wanted to understand what was at the heart of it. Who was putting out the rhetoric and this idea that who I was a problem? Who was out there institutionalizing a concept of me as the enemy? And I really wanted to find out what was going on with that. And I think that helped me really want to seek some understanding and some knowledge about, you know, what is the historical continuity of how communities of color are treated in the United States? In times of crisis, we have seen, and I hope we don't, but will we continue to see communities of color becoming the scapegoat during times of trauma and loss? And to see that historical continuity really helped me understand what was happening and helped me see what we could do to change this. Learning from the experiences of African Americans, Latinos, the Japanese American internment, etc., I think that really helped me see the work that people have done before me mm-hmm. to help build bridges, to build a community, to really, you know, I kind of had a little bit of a hand in naming our campaign, and I think for me, I really wanted to get to the heart of what I wanted to say, and which is that, you know, when I moved to this country, it was an opportunity filled with so much hope and dreams for the future. And what it was is that at its heart, I really think America is this dream that is an America for all of us. It is a place mm-hmm. that really can be a home for such a wide array of people from around the world, from so many different backgrounds, of different ages, of different experiences. And I want that America. I believe in that America. And I've experienced that America at different times. And so I want my work and my life to go towards building that, to build the country that I just know that we are capable of being, a country that is truly equal and truly lives up to its values, that goes back to its essential founding spirit of you know, entrepreneurship, neighborhood, all those ideas that come together to make us a really distinct country, you know, and I think that really mattered to me. And so I think combined with a strong sense of social justice that I've really grown up with from my parents and my family, I think that idea of working towards an America for all of us, it pushed me to find a way to contribute and potentially make a difference. And I think that is probably the single greatest determinant of, you know, how I kind of got here, started working at SALT and getting engaged with these issues. I really want to build that America for all of us. I want to be part of helping all of us build that.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Mo, for speaking with us today, and all the best in your work. It's really important what you are doing there at SALT. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Great. Talk to you soon.